The industrial heartlands are an important part of highly developed countries. However, since the scaling back of industry in many Western countries and the relocation of production to other countries, these regions have found themselves in decline. People are moving away, jobs are being cut, and optimism about the future is hard to find. These are some of the issues we will hear about today in our first episode of the Transatlantic series on the industrial heartlands. Hello and welcome everybody. My name is Rachel Stieb and you are listening to Talking Progress, a podcast by Das Progressive Zentrum. This podcast explores new ideas for social progress in Germany, Europe and transatlantic spaces. Today you are listening to our transatlantic series on the industrial heartlands and their just transition. This podcast is part of the Transatlantic Dialogue on the Industrial Heartlands, Shaping the Future, a project by Das Progressive Zentrum and distinguished partners at the Progressive Policy Institute, Georgetown University's BMW Center for German and European Studies, and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. With this project, we are developing solutions for a better, greener, and more democratic life in the typical industrial heartlands in the United States and in Germany, places that are often overlooked. What we see is that for a generation, people living in the traditional industrial heartlands all over the world have been buffeted by a technological and services revolution, the decline of manufacturing, and the rise of a borderless global digital economy. And the result is threefold. It has led to deepening inequality, ongoing political support for right-wing populists, and a hollowing out of the middle class. So, in the project, we are bringing together experienced actors across politics, the private sector, and civil society on both sides of the Atlantic to strengthen the industrial heartlands again. Our main goal for this transatlantic dialogue is to deliver increased living standards and opportunities in these regions, while also working towards rebuilding trust in democracy in the US and in Germany. In order to reach this goal and bring this transatlantic dialogue to life, we have kicked off the project in November 2023 with a transatlantic conference on the geographies of discontent. This conference was hosted by Das Progressive Zentrum in cooperation with the European Commission and the Committee of the Regions in Brussels. At the conference in Brussels, we brought together experts and decision makers from Europe and the US with a delegation of local Midwestern decision makers touring European industrial heartlands. The focus of the conference was to discuss the challenges and to share experiences on the issues that industrial heartland regions are facing. While the next episode will concentrate more on the concrete exchanges of best practices and proposals for action from its participants, this episode of our podcast will focus on the keynote held by Catherine Kluwer-Eschbrück on the democratic imperative to deliver for the heartlands. Catherine Kluwer-Eschbrück is an esteemed personality and speaker on issues of transatlantic importance. She is the Executive Vice President and Senior Advisor of the Bertelsmann Stiftung and is the embodiment of the transatlantic relations. She has lived and studied transatlantic relations in both the US and Germany. She is a fellow of the Truman National Security Project and was in previous capacities the Executive Director of the Future of Diplomacy Project at Harvard's Belfast Center, and in addition led a project on Europe and the transatlantic relationships at the Harvard Kennedy School. Moreover, Catherine was a member of the advisory council at the BMW Center for German and European Studies at Georgetown University. Catherine is an inspiring figure in the transatlantic relations and an important voice herein, and we at Das Progressive Zentrum have been working with her for quite some time. Most recently, it was on a project also in the context of the transatlantic dialogue, which sought to connect urban decision makers from the US and Germany. So we are happy to work with her again on the industrial heartlands, as Catherine is one of our sounding board members for this new transatlantic dialogue. That's why I'm honestly very excited about her keynote speech on the imperative to deliver for the industrial heartlands. And it is important to highlight that this debate we are having about the future of the industrial heartlands on both sides of the Atlantic comes at a crucial time. Right now, we are facing anti-democratic and anti-liberal threats from within and outside our societies. And we have important elections coming up in this year and in 2025. It is more important than ever to stick together and learn from each other. So this episode underlines learnings from the transatlantic exchange on the city level and discusses what can be transferred within the context of transforming the industrial heartlands. So let's hear about Catherine Kluwer-Eschbrück's thoughts on why delivering for the industrial heartlands is an imperative for progressives.
Populism as a term was rarely used in the 20th century. It was limited to U.S. historians describing in highly specific terms the original agrarian populace of the mid-19th century. And now we are living through an age of populism with its different degrees of polarization, its extremes on both sides of the political spectrum across the globe. Controllable still in parliamentary majoritarian systems, but maybe barely. Brothers of Italy, Sweden Democrats, Le Pen's of this world, moving her party to the center, even in multi-party pluralist democracy. So Sweden, Finland, all governments that move from extreme liberal attitudes to ones that can only exist in coalition with right-wing parties. And the European Union elections, the European Parliament elections in June, I think will lay bare the degree to which traditional party politics are failing to shape a credible narrative for motivated voters, because let's not forget the reason these results are happening is that voters are motivated because they feel the pressures of this accelerating degree of change in their lived realities. And under this specter of a polycrisis that's morphing into a feeling of permacrisis, of continual alertness, so a combination of pain and continual alertness, without voters feeling more equipped to engage or proactively engage with the questions that arise from these challenges. Many voters on both sides of the Atlantic feel that they're in free fall. And the current predictions, again, for the European election show really startling gains for the identity and radical conservative groups, shrinking that center majority in a way. And I'll remind you what the agenda of so many of the members of these party groups are, which is to take apart the communitarization, the joint project that is the European Union, reel back and roll back to the national at a moment, as we've heard from our various European voices today, when major projects are afoot that need to be handled together, whether it's the technological transition, the green transition, a response to fundamental shifts in energy markets, and then, of course, an enlargement that's in the offing, which will necessitate entire wholesale governance reforms in the EU. On the eve of the 33rd anniversary of the German reunification, which we just celebrated in October, President Frank-Walter Steinmeier expressed concerns that was once what was once a simple East-West divide. And I'll remind you that Chancellor Helmut Kohl once said, imagined for the East that there would be blooming landscapes. And only 10 or 15 years later, we did, in fact, have blooming landscapes because so many people had left the East and had left full railroads, full houses, full homes, full villages, full of wildflowers. Frank-Walter Steinmeier said on the anniversary of the fall of the wall, effectively the end of the separation of the East and the West, that that was now a divide of opportunities and structural inequalities that he saw now morphing more into distinct tensions between cities and rural communities. Infrastructure, medical care, education, community offerings atrophying in rural areas of largely East Germany, leaving behind disillusioned voters with limited mobility as sitting ducks for right-wing populists. Just a few weeks later, we had some critical elections in West German states, apparently not beholden so much to this divide. And still, when you looked at the result with the AfD coming in either as the second or third most powerful political party, it was clear that maybe we're looking down the line of a German-wide and not just an East-West problem. So after a year of drastic adjustments due to Russia's war in Ukraine, head-spinning incapacity to advance the twin transition, which Florian talked about at scale, with the necessary political seriousness, and though he's on the phone, Charles Aldington just talked about leadership, all while communities were left alone to tackle the burden of migration across Germany, this mix is now delivering consistently high numbers for right-wing parties. And of course, in the two-party system that you have in the United States, sticky populism has created a hostage situation. The Republican Party is now all but beholden to the votes which Donald Trump motivated to the ballot box in 2016, in some cases for the very first time. Donald Trump managed to do what others couldn't do, which is to make voters out of non-voters who had been, in fact, lifelong non-voters. But now you have the greatest promise of the Trump 2024 ticket to dismantle the deep state and with it restore a version of democracy that was all too visible on January 6, 2021. The first time in the U.S. nation's history that the peaceful transition of power, long one of the highest points of the world's longest standing constitutional democracy, was denied. And in an impressive effort, many of you will have been tracking this, the Heritage Foundation has laid out in 900 plus pages just how the next conservative government could dismantle core functions of politically neutral civil service and abrogate other core functions of democracy. Ahead of the 2024 poll, 23% of Americans now say they would not shy away from political violence. So I say to you, the call is coming from inside the House, and democracy as we know it on both sides of the Atlantic is deeply, deeply in peril. We saw an ultimate failure of politicians in the 2016 election cycle to see some of the tectonic shifts that were already afoot, that deindustry, we talked about all the phenomena here, the deindustrialization, the movement of people, the demographic shifts, a shift away from economic or a deep shift in economic transition, leaving people who felt nostalgic for an economic past and believing the promise of reindustrialization at scale, but also in this idea of a restoration of economic dignity. You remember after the 2016 election, the entire idea of dignity, political dignity, entered the discourse of political and sociological study. And what was that idea? The capacity to, what were the elements of dignity? Capacity to care for family and experience its greatest joys. I'm paraphrasing our colleague Sterling. The pursuit of potential and purpose in economic participation without domination and humiliation. That is what mattered, and that's how we were able to finally diagnose what pulled, what kind of forces pulled voters in one direction, namely into a Trump camp and out of, again, I give you, a non-voting situation in 2016. And in the European case, at the same, roughly at the same time, you saw the buffering aspects and effects of the Lisbon Treaty, which, and Peter will have spoken to this opening our session today, the freedoms enshrined in the single market, the fluidity and functionality of the single market were there to couch and capture and catch through regional funds and redistribution those that might be left behind from that kind of movement at scale and at impact. And yet that fear of loss, the fear, not the actual fact, and again, this is what we learned in studying populist movements and in studying people's behaviors around a series of critical elections then, it was the fear of job loss. It was the fear of displacement, not actual displacement or actual job loss. So relative deprivation that worked on the political processes on both sides of the Atlantic. And of course, we saw that very clearly in the Brexit vote and elsewhere. But now we're in a moment of severe acceleration because the pressures from the outside are heightened and they're more clearly perceived, whether it's the threat of a continually advancing China in terms of its economic, but also its military footprint, Russia's unpredictability in terms of its spoiler character in international affairs. And now, of course, the questions that are raised around the future of the Middle East and what that might mean for the functionality and integrity of our society here. But one thing we didn't really know quite yet in 2016, and it's come up in a number of the things that you have all raised here, is what then citizens in our, or what else sort of has weighed on citizens in rural communities. And our colleague Giuseppe Cicciolini from the European Union Institute published a very interesting paper in May about rootedness. And it's the kind of things that all of you have spoken to that touches on the social contract and social meaning that imbues the idea of dignity, but it's this fusion of social capital, meaning to say people want to be in rural places. They have strong attachment to place and to their communities, to their faith-based organizations, to their neighborhoods. And this is true on both sides of the Atlantic. So rootedness, the idea that, you know, if you don't like it here and if the economic situation isn't working for you, move, the fundamental piece also imbued in the idea of the single market, that is no longer working. What people expect, in fact, and why the populist narrative works so well, is the idea that it will come back to you. You can stay rooted, and you and change will come to you, but in a best case scenario, we will re-deliver without you having to change. If that's not a false promise, then I don't know what. But by that same token, enter, and I thought that was a beautiful description of the kind of tools we have seen come out of various efforts by the Biden administration. This idea, and this is, by the way, a study on the Italian community responses to Chinese imports. That's a European study, but it works just the same with respect to the way that voter mobilization flows from this idea that people want to remain rooted, feel that they are being forced to change and disenfranchised, and that change does not come to them in a way that they can handle the pace of the change. They can be proactive about the change. These are the kind of things that, exactly to your point about labor reform, reskilling, the kind of things that would imbue, again, where they are, their lives with value. So this idea that relative deprivation, rootedness, a lack of time for transformation, inefficient and unsupported local administrations, to Charles' point about leadership, incomplete redistribution, we heard that from Jamie, and knowledge transfer. So the idea that every time, and we were just talking about this with Ambassador Messinger, the idea that every time you build new social connections, whether it's between rural communities internationally or rural communities nationally, or even when you're engaging in bridging the city and state divide, you are building over and over again, because there is no distinct way of capturing that leadership. Those are experiences that unite Americans and Europeans, though a lack of consistent redistribution and earlier deindustrialization puts America a half step ahead, well, maybe well in front of Europe, depending on who and what you're looking at, in terms of the impact of the democracy destroying tendencies. But of course, Europe isn't far behind. And I think when we're thinking about how can we get ahead of these curves and what might we be doing together, we have to face this with some brutal honesty. So faced with this cauldron of threats, systemic in the form of China and Russia, and the emerging authoritarian coalition that is just waiting for our democracies to come unglued as we empower populace everywhere, because we are unable to heal the divisions and rifts within our societies, I ask you if partnership wouldn't be the better answer. I want to just end this section with somebody. When I became the head of the German Council on Foreign Relations, somebody said, oh, she's always quoting songs. Well, in this case, I will quote songs, because I'm not going to sing it to you. But I think the beautiful encapsulation of the moment in which we find ourselves and this concept of rootedness, I think, is so well captured by the men of north of Richmond, I don't know what. Living in a new world with an old soul, these rich men north of Richmond, Lord knows they all just want to have total control. Want to know what you think, want to know what you do, and they don't think you know. But I know that you do, because your dollar ain't SHIT, and it's taxed to no end, because rich men of north of Richmond, etc. And then verse 2, I wish politicians would look out for miners and not just miners on an island somewhere. Lord, we got folks on the street, ain't got nothing to eat. And so we were thinking earlier about how this relates to the earlier phases that begat the New Deal, which politically, as we heard earlier, is almost impossible, and yet some of the economic realities and the way that they are felt and they are perceived in communities, the pain in which they are, with which they are felt, of course, has led to other social knock-on effects. And we all observe the drug abuse, the alcoholism, and the kind of developments that have bred on reservations and, of course, across rural communities in the United States and increasingly in Europe. So if we think about what we might see as transatlantic attempts to begin to tackle the plethora, this sort of toxic layer cake that has these atrophying impacts on our democracies, I know that will be the topic of our opening or of our sort of afternoon discussions. But because I deal with geopolitics, I thought maybe it'd be good to go from the 30,000 foot level down to the more practical level and give you a couple of things that I'm thinking about. So we talked about the IRA, the impacts of the IRA, the need to renegotiate the IRA ultimately and find new formats. And I give you that part of what, of course, this war across the free and independent territory of Ukraine has done is it has forced us in the transatlantic relationship to have more honest, straightforward, and more importantly, more joint conversations. So the fact that we are currently negotiating a critical raw minerals act, the fact that we are negotiating a steel and aluminum joint tariff, GSA, depending on what acronym you choose and where you're from, the fact that we have within the EU-US Trade and Technology Council ways to map critical raw materials, to join hands, to figure out how to get at those materials in a sustainable way, the way that we're thinking about a new dialogue with what we so terribly call the global south that creates and imbues an international system with practical, tangible value in a place where we have so often co-opted and abused our international institutions ourselves and now need to claw back from what we did or how the impunity with which we brought to these organizations goes to show that sometimes these harsh containing environments can in fact be very useful. So at the macro level, when it comes to delivering the kind of transformations and transitions we need to see, pushing on friendshoring as a serious proposition instead of the subsidies race, leaning into the alignment of subsidies into raw materials, critical minerals, I just noticed the inputs of reindustrialization, because of course we are up against, and I think you said this, we are up against a ticking clock of time. I just mentioned the two elections. We mentioned that it won't be felt before any of these elections, but nonetheless, timing is what runs against us because of course the various other opposing factors do not sleep. Now is the time to reinvest and lean in that. And also in that respect, widen the West. These problems of populism, of polarization, we see this in Australia, we see this in many other countries that we are now considering part of the Western Alliance. Why not widen the aperture? And in the context of particularly, well, both the United States and the Europeans, in German, we would say, Übertragsriemen, find better Übertragsriemen, and we'll practice that in the break. It's the idea that you find people who will do the bidding of a policy for you. And mayors, the Biden administration has figured out, are the best. The Biden administration spoke to some constellation of mayors nine times between being elected and taking office, because they knew that in order to get any of this agenda realized, and I mean real, tangible, felt, carried, supported, paid for, they were going to need people to tell a pragmatic, functional story for them and to make it work. And those in the first regard were mayors. But now you have at the heart, and I was involved in setting this office up to a tiny degree, you have an entire office of subnational diplomacy within the State Department. So now is the time to think about who better to tell your story than the figurehead in the White House, because that figurehead has a popularity rating well under 40%. So it's time to lean into the people and the leadership where the stickiness and the connection still holds. That's in our cities, and in many cases, that's in our rural communities. Even though, of course, so much of the hyper-politicized and popularized fight has arrived in our state houses, has arrived in our courts, has arrived in many different subnational entities. But because they have arrived there, there is an opportunity to begin to change that narrative and to do it also in partnership and explaining and connecting with lived experience here. On the micro level, better collaboration for better delivery. So if we accept this premise of rootedness as a given, which is to say that people are less and less likely to actually uproot their lives, uproot their communities, in part because the losses they're already experiencing seem so grave, then maybe we need to work on exchanging best practice on service delivery. Ambassador Messing and I were just talking about what keeps people in villages. Well, if they have health care, if they have unions, if they have community centers, if they have culture, but also if they have things like broadband connectivity. Great story on NPR about Wisconsin and bringing broadband to Washington Island this morning, in case you haven't heard it yet. The fact that we desperately need to be able to keep people where they want to be because it enhances well-being, and the way that we do it is using technology at a greater rate and with greater equitability, can soothe, can bridge, can tie together the innovation gap that we see all the way across the European Union and, of course, in the United States. We map them, we work on the exchange of getting innovation into these areas, both on green and digital, on both sides of the Atlantic, and we get the investments right. We need better strategies on how to amplify the innovation environments and increase patent and new tech developments. Bertelsmann, my colleague Nathan Crist, is on the line, has done some of this, has mapped where patents exist. And it's true that, yes, of course, they exist, or they're made and written and brought to patents office mostly in cities. But if you begin to build innovation networks where you invest in satellite campuses, if you invest in retraining and reskilling and R&D facilities spread across the country, if you're building those bridges and incentivizing correctly, you can, in fact, increase patent and new tech development in places that are outside of cities, harnessing what we found in our latest study at Bertelsmann, the fact that in every single region across the European Union, there is some advantage either on the green or on the tech side. Identifying where those advantages are, pairing conversations, and one thing we're working on is pairing regions in a better way so that they can exchange experiences on the how-to. That is how you get pragmatic and straightforward support to one another, region to region, for the people who have to do it. And so we also, and we heard this from a couple of people speaking earlier, we also know that longstanding research reveals that the quality of local administration, quality of leadership, is responsible for garnering subsidies, for lobbying, for pushing for education funding, and for redistribution assistance, so that those things can find their full capacities. How to spend it better, how to be more present. Jamie Driscoll said, look, I lobbied harder and I got it done. Those people, the Jamie Driscolls of this world, the mayors, but also the rural leaders, need to have that capacity building. Mayors have clawed that back for themselves. It was said that I spent 12 years at Harvard, at the Harvard Kennedy School, where we have the Bloomberg City Leadership Initiative, where we bring newly elected mayors together on a basis, a model that we built around new congressional members. Why aren't we doing that for rural leaders? Where is the gap? That, given how much impact the rural vote is going to have on the integrity and functionality of democracy in the United States and vice versa here, I think it's in the common interest to reinvest in leadership development on the rural level. Both American and rural delivery agencies and administrations need that kind of connection and the support that these cities have been seeking for themselves. In fact, when given the chance, of course, they do that. The only reason that the United States is in fighting chance of achieving the 2% goals laid out by the Paris Agreement is because 196 entities banded together in America's pledge and saved the climate change agenda from Donald Trump in the White House. So, and I mentioned the twinning of the regions. These kind of operational ideas might be ones that we want to discuss as we move into the afternoon. And so many more will surface here because you, not I, are the practitioners. And then two more little things. We have to get to a point where we tell better local stories. And this, again, is true in Europe in as much as it is true in the United States. Local journalism is all but dead. Montana has now used to have three papers that were that were read across the state. Now effectively you have one. It's published three times a week, and it reaches an ever smaller number of people, because the assumption is that you can get all of this information online, and yet that is not true. Since 2005, the U.S. has lost a quarter of its newspapers, and by 2025, it will be a third. So only 1,230 newspapers still exist. Local news is all but dead. And to be fair, you have so much more infrastructure to that effect here in Europe, particularly in areas where you have state-supported media, including in Germany. But in other places in Italy, where the entire media market has been cannibalized and capitalized, similar to ways the United States has worked, that is no longer the case. So we need to learn from these developments, and we need to begin in a more directed way if we're already embracing the idea of greater state stewardship in different areas, thinking also of putting the media market on the table there. Strong local journalism, better storytelling about what works in our communities. We have people in pain, and often the ballot box is the only valve. So above all, we need to learn more from one another and from what works in our communities, from implementation to strengthening of narrative around choices and dignity and value, even in times of great change and perceived loss. We need to bring skills and reskilling to the people where they are, because rootedness will prevent the kind of motion that we saw all through the 20th century. It can take the form of new projects in the elite stewardship of resources. We need that too, the TTC, et cetera. But it will not succeed in protecting the integrity of our democracies if that second part is missing. Democracy as a system of governance remains, has always been through the history of time. And you can listen to Mitt Romney talk about the map of the evolution of democracy on his wall in the Senate. Democracy has always been endangered over the historical arc of human political interaction. In the past, we lacked the capacities to see that interconnectedness of the factors, all the factors that influence its fragmentation. No more. Linked up policies and transatlantically connected investment, including things like vocational training, trained and connected local administrators, vertical networks between cities and rural communities, universities leveraged in what I call the doing, the service provision from tech to medicine to infrastructure, all of that can help. While we might not be able to reconfigure ideology, and I'm assuming that's the first thing you're going to say to me, we won't bring people back from the ideological brink, people might support an urgency-driven restoration of comity in certain places nationally and across the Atlantic internationally. The urgency is high. Because, as was said, Florian noted, I ran a program on diplomacy for 12 years. The saying by our very first American diplomat is as relevant as ever. We must hang together, because otherwise we will surely hang separately.
With these very striking words by Benjamin Franklin, we end the keynote by Catherine Klüver-Eschbrück on the challenges for democracies on both sides of the Atlantic. An insightful contribution on what we can do at the transatlantic level, especially around the concepts of political dignity and social capital, and with the factor of rootedness in mind. What I personally take away from Catherine's speech is the very important fact that we need to learn more from each other, both at the transatlantic level, but also within a country or region, about what works at the local level, from the implementation to strengthening the narrative of choice and dignity and worth, even in times of great change and perceived loss. Because especially in these times of multiple crises and the rising right, linked policies and transatlantically connected investments can help. We need linked policies and investments at all levels, and especially where people are concretely involved in doing, such as in vocational training or even in vertical networking between cities and rural communities with trained and connected local administrative staff, but also all the way to universities. And of course, we should also include the provision of services ranging from technology and medicine to infrastructure in this process. because this is how we can support the urgent restoration of the community in certain places at the national level and also internationally across the Atlantic. The urgency of these pressing topics should encourage us to start taking action. With this brief summary, we come to an end of today's podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed Catherine's speech and found it as inspiring and thought-provoking as I did, and that you tune into the next episode when we delve deeper into the conference in Brussels where the keynote speech we heard today was given. We are already looking forward to speaking more about what the local decision makers at the conference had to say about their work, the challenges that they are facing, and what solutions and interesting ideas they have come up with. Thank you very much for listening to our podcast, Talking Progress, the podcast that explores progressive ideas for Germany, Europe, and transatlantic spaces. This was the first episode of our series focusing on the industrial heartlands in the United States and Germany with music by Arnim Mualim. Have a great day, and I hope to welcome you back at our next episode. This podcast is produced in the context of the Transatlantic Dialogue on the Industrial Heartlands project, a project by Das Progressive Zentrum and distinguished partners at the Progressive Policy Institute, Georgetown University's BMW Center for German and European Studies, and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and with the support of the German Federal Ministry of Economic Affairs and Climate Action. For more information, please visit our website at industrial-heartlands.com or check the link in our show notes.